Hello, everyone. This next talk is going to be about virtual multiprocessors on trusted workstations. I'll hand you over straight to Matthew Chapman, who's here from here, from the University of New South Wales. Let him get started.
All right. Let me start off with a brief introduction and motivation for what I'm doing. In parallel computing, obviously, one of the fundamental things that we're trying to address is that some problems makes sense to use more than one processor. So mostly it's to make it run faster. Sometimes some problems are so massive that we need to use multiple processors just to get reasonable run times. For instance, if we're doing a weather simulation, we want to be able to have that complete within the next few days and not, 3 weeks down the track when we don't care about the weather anymore. So in order to build multiprocessor systems, there's a number of approaches. The first sort of most obvious sort of approach is to take multiple processors and stick them on one bus with some memory. So this is through your typical sort of small SMP systems. You've just got multiple processors. Sometimes these days more and more than one processor on one chip. So each of these might in fact have two processors on each chip, and then you've got multiple actual processor chips, but they're all connected to one set of memory. The advantage of these sort of systems is that they're nice and cheap because they're commodity, they're just off the shelf. Even these days, desktop systems tend to be multiprocessor, dual core, dual CPU. And because all these processors are connected together on one bus, one set of memory, it's fairly fast to communicate between them. You just access the shared memory, everything's fast. Now, if you want to actually scale to more processors, then the problem is that there's only so many processors that it makes sense to stick on the one bus, because we start getting contention on that bus for the memory, and also we've got physical limitations given the speed of the bus. We've got to put the processors close together, then we have cooling issues and so forth. So typically for a single SMP node, as Leah was saying before, typically about four CPUs. When we want to scale to more, we have to build these numer systems where we have nodes of SMPs which are connected together. But in these sort of case coherent numer systems, the connection between the nodes is done such so that you can actually access remote node memory directly. So this again is a natural extension of the SMP model. In SMP you can access all the memory from any of the CPUs. In numer systems you can also access any of the memory usually from any of the CPUs, except that accessing remote memory is slower. This provides a natural extension of the SMP programming model. We might want to, in our programs, make some more optimizations for NUMA, but it's basically a similar sort of shared memory model. It's easy to use. It's a single system image, typically. You've got one copy of Linux running on your NUMA machine. You log into it. You run some programs. It's easy. The disadvantage of these sort of systems tends to be the cost, because they are custom hardware. There's a lot of research and development that goes into building these big NUMA systems. This here is a 128 processor SGI-LTX 3700 box. I think the list price is about $2.5 million for one of these. So it's fairly expensive sort of hardware. So instead, what a lot of people tend to do is instead of buying these sort of systems, they buy a whole set of off-the-shelf workstations and cluster them together. So we call these clusters of workstations or networks of workstations. Oops, wrong picture. So this is the Vena cluster here at the University of New South Wales, just a small cluster of individual systems that were bought off-the-shelf one-rack unit systems, connecting together via a network. Now, this is a lot cheaper than buying a big Numa machine. If you consider that for that $2.5 million, you could buy yourself probably 1,000 CPUs worth of these sort of systems. So you can throw more processors at the problem this way, but now you've got added complexity because you've got all these separate nodes of the network. And as Cray said, the famous quote, if you were plowing a field, which would you rather use, 2 strong oxen or 1,024 chickens? Now, it might be that there's more raw strength in 1,024 chickens, but it's going to be a lot harder to throw them at the problem of plowing a field than the oxen, which we know how to use both to plow a field. So basically the question is, can we use these clusters of workstations but simplify the programming model so that it looks more like the shared memory systems, which are easier to program and easier to use? There's a number of approaches to doing this. Firstly, there's various middleware solutions. For instance, you might have things like OpenMP, you might have distributed shared memory libraries, you might have distributed Java runtimes, all these sort of things, which try and make it easier to write distributed applications. The issue with these sorts of middleware systems is that typically you need to actually write your program to use these middleware systems. So you can't just take Oracle and run it on a distributed shared memory library, for instance. You'd have to actually write it to sit on top of that. So for a lot of applications, this might not be appropriate because you might have legacy applications that aren't written to use that middleware. Secondly, we could approach it via distributed operating systems, so we can design our operating systems from the ground up to be distributed. So basically to have a single system image across the whole cluster so you can access resources from anywhere. And there's a number of research operating systems that try and provide a simple programming model. The thing is that these research operating systems don't tend to take off because they don't provide the same sort of compatibility with all our existing Linux, et cetera, applications. And most people do have lots of legacy applications that are written to POSIX that they want to be able to run. So instead, some people have taken existing operating systems like Linux and they've tried to retrofit distribution to it. Like, for instance, the MOSIX project and Kerrigan and a few other projects like that where they've taken Linux and tried to make it into a single system image operating system. The thing with this is that it tends to be fairly invasive to Linux. And as you know, with the speed of Linux progress, it tends to be very hard to keep this up to date with the latest kernel. So you'll find some tarball out there against 2.6.12, but if you want to be running 2.6.18 for some new feature, then it's not going to work for you. So what I've been considering is, can we do it at a lower level instead of actually modifying the operating system? Do it at the virtualization level underneath the operating system. As many of you will know, virtualization's become a hot topic in recent times, and a lot of people are running Linux on top of the virtual machine. And so the question is, can we use the virtual machine layer to aid in this distribution? So typically, the thing that people use virtualization for is partitioning a system into multiple virtual systems. So, for instance, you want to be able to run multiple operating systems on a single machine. So you've got a physical machine there. Here, I've typed into three virtual machines. Two of them run Linux with little tuxes on top, and the third one happens to run Windows. And this is a nice thing we can do with virtualization. We can run different operating systems on the same machine. The Windows boxes are a little further over because it doesn't like the Linux boxes. So the question is, in this sort of system, we're basically changing we're basically giving the operating system a different set of virtual hardware from the real hardware. So the operating system thinks it's running on a real machine, but actually it's running on these virtual machines. So the question is, can we use this same set of principle to take a cluster and then run Linux on it, but Linux thinks it's running on a newer machine? So basically what we're doing is we're taking a cluster and using virtualization, creating a virtual NUMA system across that cluster, and then we can run Linux with its nice NUMA support that Lee was talking about on top of that system. So the question is this practical to do? So I've built a system called VNUMA, which is an experimental system which tries to implement this sort of environment. So what you do if you want to set up a VNUMA cluster, you take a couple of machines here, two or more. I'm just showing the basic case where we might have two machines. And we connect them with some sort of fast interconnect, at least gigabit Ethernet. Definitely something faster would be preferable, possibly InfiniBand, but gigabit Ethernet at least. So we've got some sort of decent bandwidth and latency. One of them might have a disk in it. That's not really necessary because you can always NFS boot, but let's say one of them has a disk. And the other thing to note here from this slide is that they've got Itanium processors in them. The current prototype of VNUMA runs on Itanium. The main reason for that is that I've been investigating some other research stuff to do with Itanium. And so this was a natural sort of test bed for that. And also there's some optimizations which I'll mention later that are Itanium specific. But most of the ideas would be applicable to x86 as well, so you can implement this sort of system on x86. So enter VNUMA. We run VNUMA on each of those nodes, and what we end up with is a virtual NUMA system that has those two sets of CPU and memory, which look to Linux like nodes in a NUMA system, and it has a virtual disk, which is mapped onto that real disk. It has a network, which just spits out packets onto the real network, and a virtual console, which is like for debugging a serial console. So what we end up with is a virtual machine, which is a NUMA system with two nodes instead of two separate computers. So in terms of what actually VNUMA is, it's the thin hypervisor, or virtual machine monitor, if you like. This is basically just a fancy name for virtual machine software. You boot it at the lowest layer, so it's not hosted on top of Linux. You just boot it from eLILO, which is the bootloader on Itanium, corresponds to LILO on x86. And then what it does when it boots on each node, it then goes and talks to the other nodes on the network. So it spits out some discovery packets, and it finds out what other resources are on the network. And then from there, it can create a virtual machine that corresponds to the resources that it finds on the network. And exactly one of those nodes that you boot, you have to provide a Linux kernel on one of those nodes, because then that becomes the bootstrap processor, and it starts running Linux on that node. Basically, the core of what VNUMA does is based on the idea of distributed shared memory, because what we're doing is we're trying to simulate a shared memory machine on a cluster. And so to a large extent, the main problem with that is simulating the shared memory. And as many of you will know, there's a large body of work in this area of distributed shared memory systems, which are a way of using a shared memory programming model on a cluster. And the way it works is that we use virtual memory paging mechanisms in order to simulate that shared memory. So for instance, just a simple example here. If we have some data X, which is on some virtual memory page, then we might start off with node 0 having full access to that page, read-write, and it can write and read freely. But then node 1 wants to access it, and so it page faults. And so there's a message sent from node 1 to node 0 saying, okay, I need X now. Give it to me. And so what happens is that the data gets sent back from node 0 to node 1, and now node 0 marks it read-only. So that any further updates from node 0 will then have to notify node 1. And there's various small variations on this theme, but that's basically the principle, that we use the permissions on the pages in order to be able to intercept the reads and writes whenever we need to. So the question is, how do we integrate this with an operating system or a virtual machine? Inside an operating system such as Linux, we've got, on modern sort of processor hardware, we've got virtual memory. And so we've got, inside the OS, we've got some sort of mechanism that let you map virtual addresses to physical addresses. And so typically your user space program, and probably the kernel usually, run in virtual address mode. And there's some sort of mappings established by the kernel to physical addresses, which is actual real memory addresses in the system. And there's some sort of permissions on those mappings which the OS might use in order to prevent code pages getting written and to cause to do swapping and all sorts of other things. So the thing is, when we put that on a virtual machine, we've actually got a second layer of translation. And this is the case in basically all virtual machine monitor software. We've got an extra layer of translation, which is the machine address. So now the physical address now becomes just the address known to the operating system. But the virtual machine then has to translate that to real addresses on the hardware. So there's now two layers of translation, where the OS controls the mapping from the virtual to the physical, and the virtual machine controls the mapping from the physical to the machine address, which is now the address on the real hardware. And the thing to note is that there's actually possibly permissions at this second layer of translation as well. So we could enforce extra narrowing of permissions at that level. So then the real translations that we insert into hardware page tables or into the TLB is the composition of those two mappings. But when a process is running in a virtual machine, the virtual addresses are mapped directly to the machine addresses on the real hardware. So as far as the processor is concerned, this virtual machine doesn't exist. The process is running in the same way as it would be in any other system, with virtual addresses translated to machine addresses. And this physical address layer in the middle is just the thing that the OS knows about. So just to give an example of how VNUMA can further restrict those permissions, if the OS asks for read-write and VNUMA thinks it only wants to grant read permission, then it only puts read permission into the TLB and into the hardware page table. So by doing this, it can enforce that extra protection that's needed for the distributed shared memory system I was talking about before. So that this lower layer of translation, we can introduce the distributed shared memory system. So the physical address layer, which is what the OS knows about, is distributed across the cluster. So the OS, wherever it's running, on whichever node it's running on, it sees one idea of physical addresses. But the virtual machine then translates those into machine addresses, which might be different on each node. So a page might be located differently in physical memory on this node to this node, but in machine memory. But to the operating system, it's got a global physical address. So So then what happens is when we take a page fault, the NUMA needs to decide, firstly, whether that page fault was due to something that the guest OS, the operating system, asked for, in which case we deliver the fault to OS. So for instance, if someone tries to write a code page, the OS has said in its page table that we don't want to allow that, so then we deliver a page fault to the operating system. In the case that it's not due to the operating system's permission, it must be due to the VNUMA permissions, in other words, the distributed shared memory. So in the simple case, we might do something like this. We might check whether the page is owned by another node. So another node, for instance, might have it exclusively. And now we did a read fault on it, so we might want to fetch that page to get a copy of it on the local node. So if we find that another page is the owner, we might want to send a message to request that page. If the access was for write, then we might want to send out invalidate messages to say, okay, I'm now going to write to this page. You guys no longer have up-to-date copies of it. Or we might send updates, which is something I'll talk about before, where we say, okay, this guy's, we send out on the network to anyone who's interested. We say, okay, write 4 to this address. So you might, instead of sending out invalidation, we might send out updates. So I'll talk about that in a moment. And then at the end, once we've finished getting the page data locally, we then change the permissions to allow access. Then future access to that page will just complete locally. So there's a few optimizations for that, which the actual protocol that I use is rather more complex than just a very simple distributed shared memory system like I mentioned before. This is probably not very important to understand these things, but just to make the point that I've implemented a number of optimizations so far, and there's still a number of optimizations that I'm working on. One of them is write updates. So in certain cases, instead of fetching a page exclusively when you do a write, you just send out the write data on the network. And there's certain criteria that you need to address for that to work. Firstly, you can't do that with atomic operations. For some pages, it might not make sense. For instance, if you actually are going to use a page exclusively, and of course you can't tell that ahead of time, so you need to use heuristics, but if you're going to use a page exclusively, then it makes sense to acquire it exclusively. Whereas if we just hit a page by accident over here, then, okay, we just want to send that update and keep this page read-only over here. So here, for instance, both these, this page, let's say, is mostly read-shared. So both these nodes have it for read. And then one node happens to do, there might be a rare write case. So in that case, we just propagate the write to the other node that has it for read. So in that case, we don't do the full invalidate and acquire exclusive step. Another optimization that's probably fairly easy to understand is critical word first, which is basically the same as what's done on hardware. When you request a page line from memory, typically you get it back with the word at the actual address you need first on the bus. And so I do a similar thing over Ethernet. Basically, you have to end up with 2 frames, but because it's a very low overhead protocol, it still is an advantage. So basically, when you do a fetch for address X, the first frame that comes back has the word at X, and then the next frame that comes back has the rest of the page data on that page. So in that way, you get the actual page, actual data you need at X first, so you can continue the program before you get the rest of that page data. So in terms of performance, which is probably the most interesting part of the question of whether this system's useful or not, there's a couple of different classes of applications that we might be interested in. One is scientific applications. And in this case, we can find quite a lot of scientific applications that perform really well on this system. For instance, this is the water N-squared application from SPLASH, the Stanford Parallel Applications for Shared Memory. And basically, this is a simulation of water molecules and forces and potentials and so forth. And in this case, the red is the overhead of VNUMA over the SMP case. So VNUMA basically, for this benchmark, scales almost as well as SMP, which is incredibly good. This is probably the best case that I've seen. For this sort of thing to happen, basically it's a computational-oriented benchmark, and it's fairly embarrassingly parallel. During the main computation stage, there's not very much communication happening, so it just pulls out all the data, does lots of work locally, and updates the output array. So this works fairly well on this sort of system. And then what we get is we have a single system image for free. So I just booted this system. I ran this benchmark just using fork across four processes, and it performs pretty much as well as an SMP. If I wanted to run this on a cluster, obviously it would be more complicated. This is another benchmark from SPLASH 2, also a scientific application, Barnes Hart's N-body algorithm. This displays a larger overhead, basically. It's not quite as good, but it's still usable. For the four CPU case, we get about the same as a dual SMP. Obviously, as we try and scale to more processes, that flattens out, so the scalability is not as good on this benchmark, but it's still kind of usable. On the other hand, if we look at compile benchmarks, and in this case I look at compiling VNUMA, just because I can do that on a RAM disk, but a kernel compile has a very similar sort of performance. So, as same sort of strategy as Lee, I use twice as many processor nodes as CPUs, so I do make-j4 on two nodes. And what this first graph shows is basically the write update adaption, which has some sort of improvement. As this threshold hopefully approaches 8, there's some sort of improvement over the worst case of using just write invalidate on the left and just for using the write update protocol on the right. But basically, I looked at this graph, okay, we're making some progress with these optimizations, but then you look at how fast it runs on one node, and it's a lot faster on one node. So actually we've got really bad negative scaling for this compile benchmark. So there's still a lot of work needed in order to get this sort of kernel-intensive benchmark to perform decently on this sort of extreme NUMA system. So in terms of looking at how to improve the performance, I've got a few profiling tools that I've written. The first one, which I wrote, which was possibly the most obvious thing to do but might not be the most useful thing to do, is to just plot a space-time graph of the fault address versus time. In this case, this is for the Barnes benchmark. The compile one is just too messy to make any sense of. But basically, this is the sort of graph you might see in papers as well, where as time progresses, the access pattern of the benchmark is shown there, and that's the faults that are occurring. I'm not really going to explain this shape of this because it's not really relevant. But that's one of the profiling tools that I have. Possibly more useful is this VNUMA prof tool, which I've also got on VNUMA, which is a profiler basically, and it shows you where the DSM overhead is being spent. So when there's a fault and the distributed shared memory system needs to do some work, it starts timing, and it basically creates the profile of where the distributed shared memory overhead is. So if we look at this kernel compile, we can see that 94% of the overhead is kernel, paging the kernel, which is what we'd expect. I mean, there's not a lot of stuff. The GCCs and user space are pretty much independent. The other thing to note, I guess, which I haven't highlighted, is that execute is 0.3%. What that's based, the reason for that basically is that on this sort of system, on Benuma, unlike raw Linux, code pages are automatically shared. So they've got automatic replication of read-only pages, like code pages. So basically that means that code pages of GCC and in the page cache just get replicated once and then it's all used out of that. So there's very little overhead of actually sharing the data, of sharing the code between the nodes. So execute's only 0.3%, that's execute fault. Semaphores are the other big issue, which are basically synchronization operations. That shows about 35% on that. In actual fact, it's probably more than that because some of them are actually causing invalidates as well. So if we look at what the major users are by actual function, we get raw spin lock flags, lock kernel, bunch of atomic ops, find get page, which is an atomic op. Basically, these sort of synchronization operations, which have to do with atomic operations, this is what's expensive because you really can't avoid, in most cases, doing network traffic. You can't. I mean, you can do certain optimizations, like if you grab the lock twice on the same node, you can avoid doing network traffic. But if you're bouncing around the lock, you can't avoid doing network traffic. So basically, these are the expensive things. There's still a lot of possible improvements there. Basically, one of the big issues is that because it's at a page level granularity and because locks have to be acquired exclusively, if you've got multiple locks on a page, you end up bouncing around that page like nothing else, even when there's probably no relation between those two locks. So one thing we could do is to modify the Linux kernel to put locks on separate pages. That tends to use a lot of memory though, so that's kind of evil. And often you've got locks embedded in data structures, so you don't want a lock. You don't want those data structures to suddenly stretch multiple pages. So one of the things I've been looking at is basically a mechanism for doing locks at sub-page granularity. So when it detects something as a lock and or via annotating the Linux kernel, to actually handle that word at a sub-page granularity by trapping basically all access to that word. And this so far is showing some improvement. I'm still actually working on the correctness of it, so I don't have data for that yet. Other things, I.O. Basically, I.O. is done very simply currently. You've got that one disk in one of the nodes, and all of the disk requests are routed back to that node. And network requests are sent out on each node, but they only come back on one node because the router only knows the MAC address of one of the nodes. So that's problematic. So basically, a better infrastructure for doing I.O. Ideally, what I would like, and this is sort of at odds with the goal of Benuma, which is to run on the lowest common denominator hardware. But what would be really nice is to have a storage area network on the back end, because then you can theoretically hit the disks from each node, given that the kernel data structure is already shared. Other things that might be useful is having more virtual CPUs than physical CPUs. So currently what happens is when you're waiting on a page file, you might send a packet over the network to do some sort of synchronization. You have to wait for it to come back. Currently it just spins. That's obviously non-optimal. It would be nice to be able to do some work while it's spinning. So if you've got more virtual CPUs, you can basically multi-thread. You switch to another virtual CPU and do some useful work in the meantime. And obviously the holy grail will be having a faster interconnect. Gigabit Ethernet is pretty high latency, of the order of tens of microseconds, compared to something like SGI's NumaLink, which is in the nanosecond range. So obviously a faster internet would be good. And InfiniBand is certainly an order of magnitude faster in terms of latency than Ethernet, so it would help. Other things that would be useful, firstly SMP support. Given that multi-cores and multi-processor systems are so commonplace these days, obviously it makes sense to use the multiple cores on each node before you start going into nodes. So currently, Xenium doesn't support that. Other architectures currently, like I said, Itanium, so it seemed like a good idea at the time. Perhaps these days, AMD 64 is more popular, so an AMD 64 port would be good. And another thing that might be useful, that might provide motivations for this sort of stuff beyond performance, is fault tolerance. Because once you're actually intercepting all the, well, not all of them, but the reads and writes, found the reads and writes, and you've got this virtual memory consistency protocol happening, basically you can then do logging of some of that data, and you can recover if some of the nodes go down. So that's possibly a very interesting application of this. So in that case, you might be able to forgive some performance degradation for having some sort of fault tolerance. All right, questions?
I was curious if you have considered biting the bullet and accepting that modifying the kernel is probably a good thing in this area, and doing things like making the locking primitives more aware that they're actually on the VNumer stuff, so they talk to the hypervisor and use special packets instead of trying to page fault them around.
Yes, I have. In fact, the current experimental version I've got does actually implement locks in a paravirtualized sort of way by calling into the hypervisor. So this is what I'm experimenting with. In theory, by trapping the instructions, we'll see how the performance compares, but yes, currently I'm doing it in a paravirtualized way by having lock primitives in the hypervisor. Yeah. So I'm hoping to get some performance improvements from that.
Have you thought of using the kernel hotplug stuff to add and remove nodes?
That would be another interesting application, yes. I haven't actually looked at doing that, but I did consider that possibility, yeah, that in the future it would be nice to just be able to pull out nodes and plug in nodes to this cluster. Good point.
I've seen that negative scaling that you had with the compile test on another SMP box, and was able to get the thing to run faster on a single processor box simply because the app that I was running was single-threaded. I'm thinking that's just an artifact of what you would get with a single-threaded application.
The thing is, I'm doing a parallel make, so in theory the different instances of the compiler should be able to run on different CPUs. So it's the same thing as on a Newman box, that you can parallelize a make by doing make dash j something. And the VNumer build process, like the Linux build process, parallelizes really well. So in most cases, there are four compilers running, so that those can run on the
In the case of a parallel make on the kernel, the decache is probably going to kill you, because if you have decache entry or de-entries bouncing around.
Sorry, can you...
In the case of a parallel make, say on the kernel, your decache is probably going to kill you because the de-entries are going to bounce around, particularly like the include directory.
Yes, you're right. I think the decache is also fairly high up on that profile. I only showed the top. But yes, you're right, the decache is an issue.
It strikes me that your primary conclusion is distributed shared memories is hard in a general case, works great in some specialized cases. The couple of questions I had were, I didn't see comparisons of basically bolting it on underneath the operating system with bolting it on top with a user space library approach. Did you have, I would assume the M-Flash would have very similar results.
I have a graph of that, which I was doing for an upcoming paper. Compared to Trademarks, which is a user space DSM system, it's a little worse. And the reason is that Vinuma is trying to emulate the Itanium consistency model, which is somewhat stricter than what application level DSM like Trademarks provides. So for instance, in Trademarks, you've got fixed intervals, so the application has to do a barrier before it can guarantee that, or a lock, before it can guarantee that this is visible over there and in certain ordering constraints. So in the application, I guess it's true that you've got more information available that the program has put in there. So you can get slightly better performance in application level DSM. It's not a huge difference, though.
And one other question. Since it's a NUMA system, how do you preclude the possibility of a process migrating to another machine and you have global PS and moving PIDs and attached sockets and things like that?
Processes do migrate, and Linux just migrates processes when it feels like it. I haven't looked at how efficiently it makes that decision. I know at boot time there's the measurement of migration cost, which works the same way on Vinuma, and it comes up with a certain big number, and hopefully that discourages Linux from migrating stuff too frequently, but I don't know how efficient it is in terms of how efficiently that works. I know certainly stuff does migrate. I don't when I'm doing that kernel, that Vinuma compile, I don't actually pin processes here and there. I just do make -j4, and I let Linux migrate processes onto whatever free CPUs. Yeah.
You may have mentioned this, but are you using parvirtualization for page table operations or shadow tables?
It's on Itanium, so Itanium doesn't have the same sort of issues as x86. It's not as critical to have direct page table access or whatever. So basically, it's just using shadow paging. So the Vinuma has its own page table, and on a fault, it walks the OS's page table and copies the right entry in.
Okay, thanks.
And the virtualization overhead isn't a big part of the system overhead.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Matthew, for that talk.